Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to introduce my guest co-host today and one of UNC Family Medicine's wonderful resident physicians, Dr. Jessica Hart. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And it's great to have you here. We're going to have a lot of fun today on our show because we're going to be actually talking with Dr. Thomas Kuntz, Associate Professor and Director of UNC's Department of Family Medicine, about quality versus quantity, improving healthcare. I'm excited about having this conversation.
Me too.
You know, there's so many aspects of quality, and I know in residency and throughout all of our practice, we talk about quality improvement efforts, and we're going to get a chance to talk to one of the experts.
That's wonderful. I've been working with him this rotation.
We'll get to hear about that. And first, though, we've got some interesting research that matters today. We're going to get a chance to talk about CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation guidelines. What else are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about fish and the potential to affecting your hearing.
And we'll talk about cholesterol drugs and should you take a brand or a generic. And finally,
we'll talk about assigning emergency contacts in the emergency room.
Yeah, exciting. So first off, let's talk about CPR. Now, you probably, when you came into residency, you were taught about CPR, right?
Yes.
And what did they teach you? What were some like take-home points you learned about CPR, Jessica?
That it's very difficult to do well. And everyone should have a basic knowledge in the community of what to do if they find someone down needing assistance.
Yeah, that seems like a common thing. But like, well, what should I do and how should I do it? And, you know, this is really interesting. And this particular research, which was published in the journal Emergency Medicine Australia, looked at research that had been done on videos that had been put up on YouTube about CPR.
And it sounds funny, but that's how a lot of people in my generation are learning how to do specific skills. They'll go to YouTube and try to find an instructional video. So it's important to make sure that when you're searching YouTube that you find one that meets specific requirements that is teaching you good quality CPR.
And in this particular study, which the researchers from across Turkey looked at 209 videos that were recorded in English, no advertisements, between 2011 and 2013, and they excluded those that were accompanied by ads. I don't know what kind of ad for CPR you would do, like CPR, get your free mask or something. But and what they found is that only 11.5% of these 209 videos were compatible with the 2010 cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, guidelines from the American Heart Association. Pretty shocking.
It is pretty shocking, but it looks like they evaluated the videos with 7 required steps.
Like what?
So they made sure you followed a correct order in assessing the situation, so making sure the scene was safe, that the victim was checked for consciousness. If the victim was not conscious, that an ambulance or other emergency personnel were contacted. And then it went on to appropriate positioning of your hands over the rib cage, beginning compressions, and then checking the airway and providing air if necessary.
Whew. I think I'd have a hard time remembering all 7 of those. But I think if you were looking at a video, perhaps it was to kind of give you the idea of everything that you should have. And I guess one of the take-home messages are that, you know, these videos are out there for all kinds of health things. And as you said, a lot of times people today are learning by watching these videos, yet the quality on these videos may not be exactly good enough. And the biggest thing is don't just be a bystander, but maybe get involved. And so what would be a take-home message if you did happen to find someone who you were in a safe place, they were not conscious, and, you know, you called the ambulance and you began compressions? What do they recommend, Jessica?
So they recommend a ratio of 30 compressions to 2 breaths for adults and children over age 1.
And if you're by yourself and there's no one else to help you, the biggest thing is just doing compressions at a rate of about 100 a minute. And so don't worry about taking those breaths and trying to give those breaths if you're by yourself. And this is not easy. It's physically very demanding, but this is important work.
Exactly. So don't be afraid to break ribs and break a sweat when doing CPR.
Speaking of not being afraid, I think the next study is something that a lot of people as they get older are afraid of, which is losing their hearing. What's this research, Jessica?
So this was a research conducted at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston that observed that women who ate 2 servings of fish and omega-3s each week could help prevent or delay hearing loss. It was published September 10th in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition.
Yeah, this was actually a study of over 65,000 women that were followed for almost 20 years, and about 10 to 20% developed hearing loss. And what exactly did they find?
Exactly that women who ate tuna, dark fish, light fish, or even shellfish had a lower risk of hearing loss.
20% lower. And that seems substantial, and I guess gives a little bit of weight to this idea that, you know, eating fish in your diet has a lot of benefits. Now, this isn't causal. This doesn't show that the reason they had maybe hearing protection was because they ate fish, right?
Correct.
It just shows
a correlation.
A correlation, association there. But, you know, in a day and age where we think maybe hearing loss is inevitable as one gets older, maybe it's not. And I don't know what the mechanism is here. I don't know if it's that these have anti-inflammatory markers. I'm not sure the mechanism here. But you know what? That's okay.
And they've shown that eating more fish in your diet can have cardiac benefits. So you might as well try to protect your hearing at the same time.
I agree. Speaking of protecting our arteries, this next research that matters is about taking cholesterol drugs in people who take generic cholesterol drugs versus those that have brand names on them. Study that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, very important journal. Well, what is it, Jessica? What's the study?
The study found that out of 90,000 patients over age 85, people taking generic statins had a higher adherence rate and 8% fewer cardiovascular incidents than those taking brand name drugs.
Right. So those statins are those real common drugs that people are taking for their cholesterol. And, you know, when you go to your insurance, file your insurance for your drugs, if you get a generic, you may only have to pay $5, $10 for a copay versus you have to get the brand name, it's $48. Well, I can imagine, yeah, I would be less likely to probably continue paying that high brand cost. And if I don't take my drugs, I probably have more problems with my cholesterol, which could be more heart attacks.
Exactly.
It's kind of intuitive, but you know, a lot of people say, I want to take that brand name. You had patients that tell you that, right?
I have, although I do think most of our patients appreciate us trying to be cost conscious when we're prescribing medications to them. So I actually don't really prescribe many brand name statins to folks.
And it turns out that cost consciousness actually is good medicine. That's what this research shows. Very nice. What about our last research that matters here about the emergency room and emergency contacts? You ever been to emergency room, Jessica?
Not as a patient, thankfully.
Oh, you're in good luck. And I haven't been there much as a patient. I've been there with relatives a fair amount, and we're there as doctors a lot. And I guess the question comes up, when do we want to know about who is an emergency contact? Why do we even ask that?
That's a good question. And I think there's confusion amongst patients as well, whether the emergency contact is someone you want to be identified to help notify other family members who may live further away, or whether it is whoever's supposed to be assuming decision-making for you should you become unable to make those decisions yourself.
Yeah, and so this was research that was presented at a conference in Montreal on kind of end-of-life care, and they surveyed 308 emergency room patients in the last year, and they found that only about 10% had what's called this advanced directive, but only half of those had given it to their physician, and of those patients who were surveyed, again, less than half said their emergency contact was their medical decision-maker. And I'm thinking, all this confusion about, like, what's the emergency room want to know who the emergency contact is? Is it because of this advanced directive? And why isn't the primary care doctor given it? I was kind of confused by this research.
Right. And I was confused by it as well. But I think the important take home from this was a discussion about advanced directives in our adult population particularly should be important to have the discussion within their family before they even present in the emergency room to know who they would want to be their emergency contact and the person assuming medical necessary decisions for them. So understanding the distinction between the two and assigning specific roles amongst your family and friends.
I think we'd agree on that. Well, we've had a good chance to talk about this emergency contact and the advanced directives about taking generic cholesterol drugs, maybe good for you, about eating fish and hearing, and what was that, the very first research that we did?
Performing CPR correctly and being wary of YouTube videos.
There you go. That'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Thomas Kuntz, Associate Professor and Associate Director, University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, about quality versus quantity, improving healthcare. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart. Today on Conversations, Jessica, we're talking with Dr. Thomas Kuntz, Associate Professor and Associate Director of the University of North Carolina's Department of Family Medicine, about quality versus quantity, improving healthcare.
Welcome, Dr. Kuntz. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Dr. Kuntz, we've known each other for a long time as faculty at the University of North Carolina. And the great thing about having colleagues on the radio show who are experts in certain areas is we get to ask them a question that we never asked before, which is, how did you get interested in being a family physician, and how did you get interested in quality improvement?
The first question's easy. I went to school knowing that I was going to do medicine or something in the church, and the sciences intrigued me. And the potential to help seemed expansive there. And I always thought I was going back to Fayetteville, my hometown. I had a building picked out on Hay Street, which is kind of the center of town, and knew who the nurses I was going to hire were going to be. And then in residency, just got bitten by the teaching bug. Both my parents were teachers. I guess I should have known it was inevitable.
Well, that's our gain, perhaps Fayetteville's loss,
right.
But a win-win. They led you a certain way, and we get you the rest of the way.
Yeah, and I'll be interested, honest. The quality improvement part came mostly through my interest in education. There was a need to teach these skills to residents, and so I picked that up in our department and began to explore how we can teach it to residents, and then got to be better at actually doing it through virtue of teaching it to the residents.
So what is the focus of quality improvement that you are trying to teach the residents at UNC?
I think if we can get residents in general just to be aware of the impact of systems, everyone in their life either consciously or unconsciously creates microsystems and systems and then are subject to their outcome.
Wait a second. I got to put a little time out.
Sure.
What does the word systems mean
right,
here? I'm not sure. Help me out.
So system is easy. I was thinking about what possible things I could say on the way over here. My wife and I have a new kitchen, and I make scrambled egg whites and sausage every morning for breakfast. And today I couldn't do it because it was the first time I had used that stove, and I was aware of all of the things that I normally do unconsciously being slower and taking longer because I didn't know where things were. That's as simple as a system is. You organize your life in a way that you do over and over and over again. And if you apply that repetition to healthcare, that system has outcomes, good or bad, for patients. And we need to be mindful of those.
And you're trying to teach the residents to be aware of these types of systems.
To be aware of them, and then also to know some of the basic skills to manage them. It's a little bit about human resource management and working on teams, but it's also knowing how to observe and quantify and measure and then make changes.
So help us define again another term, and then I think we can ask really educated, good questions, hopefully. But when we talk about quality, mm-hmm. What are we talking about?
Sure.
Is it everything in medicine? Is it certain things?
it really is everything in medicine. It's diagnosis of unknown problems. It's management of acute illness. It's management of chronic disease. It's appropriate application of prevention. We know, that especially around prevention and chronic disease, that physicians on average do about 50% of what they know they're supposed to, simply because of the busyness and systems that don't support them. So that's a big gap. There's lots of room for improvement.
Like what? What's something that perhaps we either consciously or subconsciously we don't do exactly the way we should?
So applying preventive vaccines. You may have one or two touches a year with a patient that is otherwise very healthy, and during their acute visit for a cold or an ankle sprain, you have an opportunity to give them a needed vaccine. But because the visit is full or you talk about other things, you don't remember to give that preventive need. And so capitalizing on all those moments and having systems that help you remember to do that so it's foolproof, that's kind of the essence of quality improvement.
And besides engaging physicians, you're also working to engage other members in our Family Medicine Center to help us perform vaccines when they should be. So can you talk a little bit about how you're trying to engage support staff to help improve our quality?
Sure. So we have a team of certified medical assistants and nurses that are a big part of our health team. They bring the patients in from the front and get the visit started. And what we're trying to do is put in mechanisms so that those members of the team can actually do more contribution to the visit so that they flag and get ready the preventative measures that might be indicated, like a flu shot or a vaccine to prevent pneumonia, to go ahead and get those things done so that you consciously have to opt out of them happening rather than just forgetting to do them.
So if we think about the whole universe, which you've just kind of thrown into our laps, of medicine that mm-hmm. is subject to quality, mm-hmm. I would think many of our listeners and our patients would say, well, the quality is already good. Mm-hmm. Give us some examples of where you as a leader in a healthcare system says, we need to get better. Give us a couple examples and how you pick those of the universe of things you could pick.
Sure. So there's a lot of different ways you could stratify that. You could look at the things that are most likely to affect the most people. So you look at things like colon cancer prevention and breast cancer prevention and really focusing on getting folks the preventative screening that they need. You could also look at the things that are perhaps less likely but affect the most people. Unfortunately, tobacco abuse is a big problem, and we can prevent pneumonia rates if we give cigarette smokers a pneumonia vaccine. And we don't do that with 100% fidelity.
And I know you've been working a lot on diabetic mm-hmm. quality improvement. What sort of things do you work on in diabetes? Give us an example in how successful or not it is.
Right. So those measures run the whole spectrum. There are things that are completely patient-driven, where a patient can identify a goal. We know that a patient focusing on their diet and exercise helps bring their diabetes under better control. So helping a patient identify a real goal, all the way to something more finite and perhaps minuscule and physician-oriented, but looking at labs on a regular basis and picking the right labs to do on an annual basis, looking at the back of their eye to prevent blindness. There are a lot of screens that we miss because we get so focused on just checking their sugar.
I remember that I've seen the last few months when I go in to see a patient with diabetes that my nurse has given me a little reminder that says, everyone know what the reminder says from the nurse? Check the feet. Mm. And it's like, oh, it's my best intentions to check the feet of all my diabetic patients, but I forget. And that's a quality indicator, right?
For sure, for sure. So there are, if you think about kind of the big five, there's blood pressure, there's glycemic control, sugar control, cholesterol control, check of their eyes and check of their feet. Those five things have been held up by several national organizations as kind of the baseline of what we should do. And they're very hard to remember to do every time and every visit. Some of them are simple physician behaviors like checking the feet, but some of them rely on the patient to work on their diet and take their medicines and check their sugar.
And some of the ways we as physicians are helping to remember to do some of these important checks is the use of reminders on our computers with electronic medical records. So how do you think that electronic medical records have improved care, and has it enhanced the quality of care we now provide?
So if you compare an electronic medical record practice to one that was completely paper-oriented just a few years ago, the improvements are just leaps and bounds. it's impossible for a physician with a paper chart to remember every patient that needs every screening every time. It's just not doable. And we know that from looking backwards with lots of studies. The EMR, the electronic medical record, lets someone know without having to do anything active about it that a screening or a test is needed. So that leap is huge. And then the second level leap that's occurring now with new EMRs is that you can actually look at your data in aggregate and reach out to the patients that are missing something rather than waiting for them to come in. And that's a huge shift from just taking care of the patient that's there, but managing your entire population at a time. We simply couldn't do that before.
Is there any concern that with electronic health records, we can do everything, and yet time is a finite in a medical encounter? And so how do we balance this? We can do everything if we had unlimited time with a finite amount of time in picking and choosing. How do you think about quality in the finite time arena of the physician-patient relationship?
Right. It's a great question, and I think it gets to a lot of people's anxiety about an EMR.
Electronic medical record, huh?
Yeah, thank you. I myself am a little bit of a Luddite. I'd like not to use the computer in the room so much. But its opportunity is that it empowers other people that are part of the healthcare team to do more in the context of the visit. So I don't have to check the feet. Any member of the team can do that. I don't have to order the Pneumovax. Somebody else on the team can do that. So if we have some time that all of us are invested, it actually increases my time when I'm with the patient to be able to connect with them in a real way so that all those other things can kind of become background and we pay attention to whatever their real issue is at that moment.
Wonderful. We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Thomas Kuntz, Associate Professor and Associate Director of UNC's Department of Family Medicine, about quality versus quantity, improving healthcare. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart. We've been talking with Dr. Thomas Kuntz, Associate Professor and Associate Director of the University of North Carolina's Department of Family Medicine, about quality versus quantity, improving healthcare. And Dr. Kuntz, right before the break, we've had a really interesting question. We're giving some really good examples of some of the quality improvement efforts that one might take and how a team approach is essential. I wonder if you can share with us a quality improvement effort or that comes to mind that maybe didn't work well and what we learned from that. Because it seems like it's not just about always making the right interventions that work. Sometimes mm-hmm. we learn from our mistakes.
Mm-hmm. We tried a couple of years ago to aggregate all of our preventive efforts into one handout that we gave patients at the beginning of each visit. And it went through several iterations and the language was revised several times. And at the end of the day, it was simply too much to consider at every visit. So we needed to rein in how frequently it was given to patients and then to find some way to prioritize the things that were on the sheet. It simply had so many things on it that it got to be a little bit overwhelming. And we had given it to patients to do on their own instead of kind of guiding them through it and helping them think about what they had and using the record to help them remember. And so now we're using the electronic record in a little bit better way to kind of take those one by one.
And how does this patient interest in participation work? Because it sounds like that's something that's actually relatively new. And I know that we're doing a lot of efforts, and I know a lot of clinics are, to involve patients. How is that working in quality improvement? Are patients involved in helping decide what interventions they want and they prioritize?
They are. There are a couple of things that go into that. On the surface, it certainly sounds like a good thing to have if a patient's active and engaged that they'll do better. It's true, but it's also proven that if you ask a patient how confident do they feel managing their chronic illness, you can actually use that number to predict how well they're doing with their disease control. So if they have a high confidence score, and also if they have a well-identified goal that they want to work on between now and the next visit, they're more likely with those two things in place to stick with it and work hard on their chronic disease management. So we're really partnering with our CMAs, our certified medical assistants, and the patients to be very deliberate each time to ask them about how they're feeling about their chronic disease management and what goals they want, knowing that that will influence the whole plan overall.
Have you gotten any pushback from patients about changes to their visit?
We haven't yet. We are in the first of many steps of really augmenting what we want to do before the time with the physician begins. Right now, we're certifying that medication lists are correct. We're going over history together, and we've just begun asking about goals and barriers to care and confidence. And we expect that we're going to continue augmenting that time before the physician even gets there. In time, that could be as much as 20 minutes before the physician even comes. But if you look at it, patients tend to wait a little bit anyway. And so what we're thinking is that if we can make that value-added time, that patients would actually be more appreciative than 20 minutes in the waiting room doing very little. We hope that's going to bear out.
You know, I've often said that good drugs prescribed for the right reasons and the right amount is good medicine. And I think the quality discussion seems to be also, you know, we have the right thing to improve and we design it the right way and better outcomes, that's good medicine. But is there, tell us about the financial aspects, because there are financial aspects driving quality improvement. And I want to be certain that we address those so we can be certain that we do continue to focus on all three of those good things that would result in good medicine.
Sure. So there's a couple of ways to think about the finances around it. Certainly if I work very hard with my patients who suffer with diabetes to keep that under as good control as possible. In the course of their life, they have less complications and less expensive therapies for their kidneys and their eyes and their feet than if someone that we let it run out of control. So long game plan, it is much more effective to take good care than to leave unchecked. Beyond that and more immediately, there are a lot of healthcare payers that are beginning to recognize the value of increased quality so that they will reimburse a physician better per visit if they know that the physician consistently applies quality metrics. And the way that translates for the patient experience is that if I'm reimbursed more in the long run, then we can actually spend more time with our patients because we're not caught on this very rapid treadmill of trying to get people in and out of the office.
And so instead of being reimbursed for doing more tests, maybe reimbursed for doing the right test.
At the right time.
At the right time, which is a win-win.
Mm-hmm.
Win for the patient, win for the provider, win for the healthcare system.
Right.
Nice. What about this aspect of quantity versus quality, which we named the show? Are there some examples in the work that you've done where, you know, the quality improvement effort maybe is small, but it's really still critically important to you versus I'm going to pick this one that's affecting the entire healthcare system, which I'm going to ask you about a little bit about medical errors, but I'm not asking about now.
Mm-hmm.
What about these little small things, but yet they're doable and important? Are there any things like that that are important to you?
Well, I mean, if you look at some of our metrics, even a 1 or 2% change in the meter right now is a huge difference.
Like what? What would come to mind?
So even retinal exam rates, that's a really hard thing to get done and to get paid for and have everyone to have access to. But that prevents blindness in folks that have diabetes. And it's something that people have not done very well in the past. So being able to make even a small change, that's a lot of healthy vision for folks over the course of their life. And that makes a big difference.
And for patients who don't necessarily want to take the time to go and have these exams done, even though it's for their benefit, how do you try to counsel them on getting some of these quality measures that they may not see immediate impact to their health?
Right. So beyond counseling them, let me say that one of the things about quality improvement is making it as easy and accessible for the patient as possible. So doing the foot exams in the room and having a retinal camera there in our office so people don't have to travel to other providers is a big part of it. And then also, I think having a continuity relationship so that someone knows over time that I really have no vested interest in ordering unnecessary things. It's the value of being a family doc. They can see both over time how their A1C is changing and how we work together. But then when I recommend something for their diabetes, they know that it's in their best interest, not just a test to order.
I know we got time for like two more questions. I got one real quickly, and it's not fair because it's a huge issue, but I mentioned medical errors. Mm-hmm. Huge problem. Tell us from a system perspective, because that's kind of where you started. How do we think about medical errors? Are there any efforts that you're involved with at the University of North Carolina, the Department of Family Medicine, elsewhere, to reduce medical errors?
Sure. So one of the things that we do in our department specifically is we have taken the traditional morbidity and mortality report, which people may have seen on TV shows or movies where you kind of analyze error and yell and blame people. And we've changed that into a quality and safety improvement conference where we look at an outcome that wasn't what we wanted. And we analyze it from start to finish. And at the end of each conference, try to identify a systematic improvement that can be made based on that conference.
We've been talking with Dr. Thomas Kuntz, Associate Professor and Associate Director of UNC's Department of Family Medicine, about quality versus quantity, improving healthcare. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call question about someone who's pregnant and having pain near their gallbladder.
I'm in my second trimester of pregnancy, and I suffered from severe nausea during my first trimester. I'm now having episodes of severe pain in my right side under my rib cage. It's definitely worse after I eat certain meals, but it scares me when it comes. My husband had his appendix out last year, so I'm worried about the pain and the baby. I have an appointment with my doctor, but I would like to know your thoughts.
Well, thank you for sharing that question. And boy, I'd be concerned too. I'm not pregnant, nor have I ever been, but I'd be concerned anytime that someone is pregnant develops abdominal pain. It's concerning, right, Jessica?
Exactly, especially after her first trimester wasn't the easiest for her either.
Yeah, feeling having severe nausea. But there are certain things about this particular case that are a little more reassuring, and reassuring that it's a gallbladder-related problem versus something that might be more of an acute medical emergency, like a real problem with the baby.
Exactly. So the thing that sounds
reassuring would be this right upper quadrant pain at the gallbladder after meals.
Exactly. And we know that having issues with the gallbladder is something more common in pregnant women because the gallbladder has less motility than it does otherwise. There's more estrogen, which creates more cholesterol, and cholesterol stones are 80% of the stones found within gallbladder disease.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
And so I guess the question really comes up here is, first off, is this going to go away during pregnancy? Well, I think we'd both say
Probably not.
Probably not. And then the question comes, since you've had this multiple times, should you see your doctor? And we'd probably both say,
yes.
Yeah. And then what do you think? You think we're probably going to need to get that gallbladder out during the pregnancy?
Probably. And luckily, there's an easy screening tool to see if there are stones affecting the gallbladder. So just an easy ultrasound to determine whether there are any that are close to the duct, which could end up becoming a more painful experience if the stone is trapped in there. It looks like there may be some concern whether it could be related to her appendix, since her husband had his appendix taken out. But the appendix is located in the right lower part of the abdomen, so probably less concerning that that is what's affecting her pain.
I agree. But I do think that before that appendix comes out, you should let your husband know that you need to go out to a really nice restaurant and get a really nice meal, probably a low-fat meal, but a really nice one before you go see that doctor. But don't put that off. Thanks for a great question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I've seen the same doctor for several years now, and I consider myself very comfortable with her. Just recently, I began to ask her how she's doing with her life. I don't want to take her time during our visits, but I want to encourage her in her life just as she's encouraged me to lose weight and take better care of my health. Do other patients do the same? It may be a nice way to encourage nurses and doctors. I just wanted to share my thoughts with other listeners.
Well, you know, I do think some patients do this, And particularly when you have this relationship between patients and doctors that evolves over time, you know, it is one of caring. The doctor will care for the patient, and hopefully over time, and probably really close at the same time, the patient cares for the doctor. And that's a good aspect of what makes a healthy, I think, patient-doctor relationship.
I think the goal with all of us in medicine is at some point to just be having a conversation with the patient when we're having the visit with them, rather than more like an interview question-answer type experience.
So, right, the doctor knows everything and patient exactly. needs to hear everything. And there'll be times at which, you know, that's probably helpful. I mean, I know sometimes when I come into a room and if I'm really just kind of running late or I'm feeling kind of real harried from things in my life, and patient says, you know, you don't look good today, Dr. Goldstein, or, you know, that just is like, oh, goodness, you know what? I can't just shrug off everything. I need to, you know, say, yeah, you know, right. It's a kind of a crazy kind of day. Thank you for pointing that out to me. And, you know, let's try to really helps me focus in on, too, what I'm doing. So I think it is useful and helpful and many times to have this kind of reflection.
I agree, but not all patients do it. So I'm sure your doctor really appreciates when you ask her or him how she's doing.
Thank you for sharing that. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My 4-year-old fell on the playground at school. His wrist was swollen a bit, and he refused to use it. I was unsure whether we should go to our clinic or if we needed to go to the emergency department. We finally went to our clinic, and the x-rays showed 2 breaks. So I ended up going to the emergency department for a temporary cast. Boo!
Well, boo that it's broken. I mean, that's no fun, and I'm kind of sorry because it's going to have, you know, probably a cast on there for 6 weeks or so. That's not good.
No, and when he was having fun, too, I'm sure, playing in the playground.
Yeah, no, and, you know, these things happen. And, you know, good for you that you decided to take him in to be seen. And I guess one of the questions kind of didn't say it, but maybe asking is, should I take him directly to the emergency room versus the clinic? And, you know, that's not an easy thing to say. I mean, boy, isn't it easier for all of us to say the next day what we should have done versus at the time it occurs? And, you know, what if I tell you that the emergency room has a 12-hour wait and you get in to see your doctor in 15 minutes? You know, you got in quickly and you got the diagnosis quickly. That's pretty darn good.
Exactly. And that should be most patients' first thought, is to go see their primary care physician rather than trying to go to the ER, mainly for their convenience sake.
And because it may not have been broken, and you might have been able to have gotten a splint placed there if needed be. And, you know, perhaps the family doctor or your primary care doctor seeing this and getting the diagnosis maybe it paved the way to get the right treatment by the right person, may have saved you some time and effort. I think this is a good story and good care. Thanks for sharing it. Erica, what's our very last house call?
I've been having issues lately, and I'm not sure if it's anxiety, depression, or both. I'm having difficulty coping with stress, and I've never had this problem before. It's now impacting my day-to-day life, and now that I'm aware of this issue, I really can't seem to move forward. I have trouble sleeping, and my health has even started to impact my relationships. Where do I turn?
Well, I think we're sorry to hear of this distress. It's distressing, and you know, that's part of that stress, is having that overwhelming feeling. And it could be anxiety, it could be depression, it could be stress, it could be all three of those things.
But I definitely think it is worthwhile for you to go in and speak to your physician, and he or she will be able to direct you to other resources if needed, and if not, just to have another person to help talk you through what's going on and try to find the source of your stress.
Certainly, having a therapist will be really helpful for this. You may well have medications that will be useful. It's a team approach, and it starts by willing to approach someone. So I agree fully, Jessica. This is a good place to start. Talk with your primary care physician. Talk with your therapist, and good luck. Well, we want to thank all of you for all of your good questions today, and we want to thank you for joining us today for your help, your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health.
Please share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Thomas Kuntz. And, of course, our great guest co-host today, Dr. Jessica Hart. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Jessica Hart.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.